Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's estimated that American nonprofits receive somewhere between 30 and 40% of their yearly revenues in the final month of the year. In fact, one survey says as much as 41% of nonprofit revenues come in the month of December. Today on the program, we look at America's philanthropic heart and the new emerging trends in philanthropy with two guests, attorney Philip Haney, who specializes in nonprofit and charitable organizations and philanthropic law. He's the principal of Philip S. Haney Associates, and he actually teaches classes in philanthropy as well. My other guest is the CEO of the Tulsa Community Foundation, Phil Lakin, who's managed that foundation since its inception. The Tulsa Community Foundation is the largest community foundation in the entire country, managing well over 900 funds and has over $4 billion in assets. Together, they offer their thoughts on the enduring traditions of American philanthropy and the new expectations that savvy donors are placing on nonprofits and charities. Phil Lakin and Philip Haney are my guests today on Studio Tulsa. Philip Haney, Phil Lakin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the trends in philanthropy. Well, you look at the explosion in the nonprofit sector. There's been a huge explosion of organizations. So the needs and the money being raised is being spread even further and further. There's debate over 501c4s, the social welfare organizations. Lots of interesting trends in philanthropy. I want to start with you, Philip Haney. Your attorney is specializing in philanthropic law. What are some of the most important trends undergoing philanthropic efforts today?
Well, there are new trends affecting philanthropy. I've watched this business for more than 30 years, and it seems like in the beginning of that 30 years, persons and foundations gave charities money and expected charities to do the right thing with it, and that was the formula. That's all changed. Now what we're seeing is discerning and wise donors with money, with expectations, with business finesse, with access to understanding where money should go and what needs should be treated with the funding. There is a lot more involvement of donors in philanthropy than previously. Some of this has been brought about by the internet. Some of it has been brought about by the world getting smaller by virtue of communication. Some of it has been brought about by different types of accumulation of wealth in the U.S. and other civilized countries. And also the publicity of needs worldwide, as opposed to, I think, what used to be more common, charity starts and ends at home.
Well, I think another facet into that is the fact there have been a few scandals in nonprofits where you find that most of the money being raised goes back into fundraising as opposed to actual work on a mission sort of situation. And that has, in turn, burned a lot of donors into demanding more transparency. Phil, as a CEO of a major foundation, how important is that transparency?
It's vitally important. Donors have access to the internet. They go to GuideStar.org. They go to Charity Navigator. They go to a wide variety of different resources to really find that information, find out what the percentage spent on fundraising expenses is, find out how much actually makes it to the program services for the charity. And that's an important number to know. You want your money to go to the recipients of that charitable organization, those who are hungry, those who are poor, those who aren't getting the educational services that they need. And that's where donors want their money to go. They understand there are administrative expenses to be covered and taken care of, but minimal administrative expenses seems to be the hallmark of what donors want in today's age.
And, of course, administrative expenses, depending on the charitable organization, can vary widely.
They can. That's right. In Tulsa, I think the United Way always talks to us about spending 9 or 10 cents on the dollar, less than 10 cents on the dollar for administrative expenses to go out and collectively do fundraising for 60-plus different charities. And that's a really good number. Anything less than 10% is a really, really good number. There are organizations that have to spend 30 or 40% out there because they're more national in focus. They have more mailing expenses. They have more development costs. And that's not negatively a bad number, but the donor has to realize that less is going
to programs. Or you have people in positions of expertise that they have to compete with the private sector for.
That's right. And the smaller the organization, generally, the higher leader. The operating expenses, because you just have to cover those typical salaries, those typical fixed costs like rent and occupancy. And so don't take it out on the smaller organization because they're a little bit higher, but expect that over a period of years that operating expense number will decrease. And if it's not decreasing, then the donor needs to go in and ask questions why.
Yeah. How, from the charitable foundation's point of view, how closely do you look at all that transparency of the organization?
We look all the time. In fact, I might have signed 50 different grant checks yesterday alone, and I may have looked at 20 different 990s. The 30 990s that I didn't look at were because I had looked at 990s on those organizations in the last month or month and a half. But I look through those. I'm trying to verify the independence of board members. I'm trying to verify the financial stability of the organization. Then I'm looking at page 3, trying to calculating the program expense ratio compared to the total expense ratio. Just how much is going to program expenses and how much is going to fundraising?
There are now charities being created to do essentially that only, to do the look.
Basically, to be the watchdog.
To be the watchdog. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of them is named GiveWill, and it's a very interesting organization. It has been funded by some substantially wealthy foundations and donors, largely to help them give their money effectively. They have a lot of money, and they want it to be given effectively, but they don't want to do the work themselves. So they've established or are grubstaking a charity that can do the work and will. And that particular charity now is only recommending to donors to give to charities that are providing for persons who are either hungry or have disease or are starving or are somehow afflicted by a lack of human need, primarily in emerging countries or in Africa. There's a co-founder of Facebook, Dustin Moskowitz, and his wife have started an organization that is supporting GiveWell, and they've accumulated a lot of wealth. 28 years old, a net worth exceeding $5 billion. And its most remarkable philanthropic statement when he said, "This money has accumulated around me unexpectedly, and my intention is to flush it back into the system effectively." And then he wondered, how can that get done? And then he and his wife looked at GiveWell, and they're supporting GiveWell to help them and others like that get money into the philanthropic system that will make a difference for those truly in need. And GiveWell is only recommending 3 charities. One of them gives cash directly to poor persons in Kenya. Another distributes malaria nets that are somehow treated for insecticide. And one other organization that inoculates persons who are inclined to disease in Africa. Their thinking is, this is the morally right thing to do with our wealth because so many persons are starving or dying, and we have accumulated wealth. We need to give most of it away to those who have none.
That brings up a really good point. You know, the old adage is charity begins at home, but now there's charity around the world, and there's a lot of ethical discussions in philanthropy about whether it's better to spend, say, $200,000, $500,000 in the U.S. to save one pediatric cancer case when that $500,000 would save up to 400,000 to 500,000 lives by having mosquito nets to prevent malaria in Africa.
Right.
Talk about that, those sort of ethical situations. Are donors actually thinking about those things, or does charity still really begin at home?
It's a difficult thing to analyze because everybody has their own set of initiatives and desires. So there's a lot of donors in Tulsa who really want to support Tulsans because they drive by that need every day. So if you're driving down the corner and you see a homeless person, or if you go visit the Day Center for the Homeless, or if you go to a wide variety of our nonprofit organizations, you see that need. How do you erase that need from your brain after you've just seen it? So it's very easy to give to meet the needs of those who live right here. Whereas in Africa, let's say, those people are quite a distance away. We are more connected to them via the internet and via other modes of communication.
But that's usually only when disaster strikes.
That's right. It is a lot less costly to influence the outcome of those people's lives just because of the standard of living and their needs are just so different than the needs that we have here in America. And I talked to many donors who are at the, well, I think every donor I've ever talked to said, you know, the value of life is equal. Whether you're African, American, Asian, it doesn't matter. Life is life. It's just that they can see what the needs are here. They can see the effects of their money. They can see those outcomes, and they can participate in it. Whereas with some people, they just can't participate in the same way if they're giving to a foreign country.
Philip, I want to touch on something else you mentioned to the Facebook founder saying, you know, he'd come into this money and he wanted to flush it back into the system with a purpose and to make a difference. I'm wondering, Phil, as a CEO of the Tulsa Charitable Foundation, you're coordinating with a whole bunch of groups that have their charitable money sort of all together, as I understand it. So there are many people making decisions about where money goes. Would you say that's the general trend for most of your clientele, this idea of really bring this money back into the system to make a difference with emphasis, I guess?
Yeah, it depends on the donor. At the Community Foundation, individuals or corporations create a fund with as little as $5,000. So it's their own individual fund. It's in lieu of creating a private foundation. So our funds go from $5,000 to billions of dollars. And each one of those families has a very different style or purpose in their giving. So some do have that philosophy, as Philip Haney just talked about. Others are doing it for religious reasons. Others are doing it for truly altruistic reasons. It just really depends. Some are first-generation philanthropists. They didn't learn any of this from their families, their parents. And some have seen this from their parents and their grandparents, and they're just continuing on that family tradition. Some react. We have one donor who brings in 250 envelopes that he and his wife receive in the mail. And he writes up in the corner, $100 for this one, $150 for this one. So he's trying to, it's a shotgun approach for him. He wants to take care of all the needs that are making themselves present and known. We have others that take that rifle approach. They say, we just want to intervene in the cycle of poverty, period. Or we just want to give to early childhood educational initiatives. And that's it. That's the only place that they give. And it's fine because we need philanthropists of all kinds giving to all those various places.
And this brings up another trend in philanthropy, which is that, as you mentioned earlier, Philip, was the idea that I'll give the check, they'll do the good work. Now, a lot of times the donor is actually involved in making sure that the money they're giving is going to a particular area and that it's actually making a difference, benchmarking. Is this making an identifiable difference? Can you speak to that?
Yes, I certainly can. Donors are more than looking for financials and metrics. They're looking for results. And there are several ways to determine results. How many youth are now reading at grade? How many women have been sheltered from abusive relationships? How many first-time college students have graduated on time? All sorts of metrics and things like this. But the result that seems to be the result that's being looked for is the most effective use of money and how efficiently can it get done. The one charity that comes to mind is the charity that is now transferring cash to poor Kenyans, just giving them money. Now, when it seems peculiar to think about that, there are certainly examples of that in the U.S. in the relationship between poor persons in the U.S. and the government. There are subsidies that are probably the equivalent of giving cash to persons. But for a U.S. charity to give cash to Kenyans might raise an eye. It's kind of an interesting concept, but it does several things. First, I think there's a lot of screening about who's going to get that cash. Second, it obviously stimulates the economy some, but it enables those persons to then buy the essential needs of life, milk, water, medicine, shelter, clothing, safety, things like that. And there are donors looking for this. Now, a man named Peter Singer, who is a Princeton ethicist, I'm not sure he was at Princeton in 1971 when he wrote his well-known article called Famine, Affluence, and Morality that has been assigned to many high school and college students and is a fairly well-known work in ethics. Gave a TED Talk in March that has renewed interest in this subject. Got 600,000 hits as of November 2013, apparently causing quite a bit of attention. But the consequence of his essay is, like we've been discussing, what is the value of a life and where can that life most effectively and efficiently be influenced by philanthropy? And one illustration he gives, of course, is the seeing eye dog. To train and equip a seeing eye dog and the person supported by that seeing eye dog in the U.S. cost about $40,000. But there are inoculations that can be used in Africa that cost about $20 or $40 that largely will eradicate the likelihood that those persons will go blind. So where is the money creating the largest difference? Where is the impact? Now, nobody in need of philanthropy should be shorted, but Peter Singer's thinking is the money needs to go on this globe, on this planet, where it can be used to save the greatest need, and this is a fundamental human need. Now, the consequence of Peter Singer's popularity, again, is that it may cost local cultural charities some giving, because it's likely that his followers wouldn't be as inclined to give money to cultural groups, including music and education and science and things like that. So there has to be, as Phil says, there is a large mix of donors, and there has to be a balance of how money is given and where it's used, because the real definition of charity is so broad. All kinds of things that government would do or could do or that civilized societies can benefit from, and it includes culture and science and religion and human need.
My guests today are Philip Haney, an attorney specializing in philanthropic law, Phil Lakin, a CEO of the Tulsa Community Foundation, as we talk about some of the trends in philanthropy. This month, in December, 30 to 40% of total charitable giving occurs. We're talking about some of the trends in philanthropy. Getting back to that idea of measurable benchmarks, which that's often happened, especially in social service charities, that's a real tough one because, you know, if you're trying to break the cycle of poverty and your organization is on one facet of poverty, it's really hard to make a difference when there's all these different factors factoring into poverty. How important is that to a lot of charitable funders? That idea of benchmarks and measurable benchmarks and achieving that.
The more sophisticated you get, the more important those numbers are. For the vast majority of philanthropists, individual philanthropists, I think there's a basic benchmark out there that you want to know. The vast majority of your money is going to the program services, so paying the salaries of counselors who are actually face-to-face with kids who are going through an emotional crisis, salaries of teachers who are sitting in the classrooms with the kids, the purchase of canned food that's going to be used by a needy family, those type of things, rather than stamps, telephone expenses, general and administrative expenses like that. And so the vast majority of us will be happy if 90, let's just say 80 to 90% of that money goes for program expenses, not management in general and fundraising expenses. But when you get into the larger foundations, as Philip has just said, you really do get into that outcome-based measurement. You want to know where kid number 1A would have been without your support and is going with your support, and kid number 1B and kid number 1C. Now, you don't individually measure them, obviously, but you measure them as a group because you want to know if your hundreds of thousands or if your millions of dollars worth of investment are really changing the outcome for that kid. If you give food to a kid in Africa, they're going to go from 50 pounds overweight to maybe normal weight because you've provided the most basic need, food. Whereas in America, most kids are going to be fed, but they may not be going to an educational institution where they're going to receive individualized educational support that is going to help them break out of their family's generational cycle of poverty. And for some donors, that's where they want that kid to end up, not on the welfare system, not, you know, waiting on something to come, but making something come for themselves. So that's important. The more sophisticated you are as a donor or philanthropist, then the more important those measurements become.
I was just reading an article, I think it was from the Stanford Trends in Philanthropy, and it was making the case that more donors are getting involved with the charity and trying to make that difference. But mm-hmm. he said there's some important things to keep in mind. One is a lot of times an organization will come in, they'll make a one-time gift, and then they're asked to justify it. And he said one of the things that's really important, if you're going to take that approach, you have to develop a relationship with the charity so that they'll be free to share bad news when things don't go well, as well as this sort of multi-year approach, because it's I think he kind of likened it to how a lot of charities work with people who need help. It's sort of a hand-to-mouth sort of thing. If a donor is going to a charity one time, it's like, there's this sort of same relationship there, and it's important to actually create a relationship where, you know, you're going to be together to try to fix this problem together.
Right.
Is that something most donors are willing to do, or some donors are willing to do?
It seems like most donors are willing to do it. Most major foundations are willing to do it, where they make multi-year commitments, and they really do get in the weeds with the nonprofit organizations. The executive director of the foundation sitting down with the executive director of the charitable organization, agreeing on a multi-year commitment, because a lot of times donors will come in and they'll say, hey, here's a new approach, here's new research, or here's research that we could do. And if the donor is not willing to make that big commitment, then the charity can't expect success. But the charity has to have a very honest discussion back with the donor and the foundation.
Speaking of the bad news and Phil's comment about the honest assessment of programs and services of charities, especially those supported by private foundations, I've noticed that the charity GiveWell has an objective that is a bit different, and it is to out the bad news basically by finding the research of existing private foundations that has determined that some of the programs they've grub-staked or invested in with charities have not been successful, but that the lack of the success or the failure of those experiments hasn't been publicized, is not out for the public. And the thinking of GiveWell is that full transparency is a very powerful resource for the needs of future donors in philanthropy. And the best way to evaluate charities is to mine all of the information available in philanthropy with private foundations, successes and failures, to build systems, to build computer models that can then define the most effective use of philanthropy. That's what they're up to, and they're pretty well funded. And another concept I wanted to mention was what's called effective altruism. And here's an example of the way it's working. A good student is about to graduate from MIT, a strong student with high grades, somebody who is proficient in finance, math, science, and computer. But this person also has a deep passion for care for animals and for safety for animals or another charity like this. Two choices: go to work for the charity and give up Wall Street, or the other choice that seems to be promoted by effective altruism, and it's this: find the best job on Wall Street, make the most money, and give most of the money you make back to that favorite charity of yours, and watch it closely, sit on the board, or get involved with it, and make sure that it uses all of that money you gave it and others like you to hire other people to do good work and to carry out the programs and services that attracted you to it in the beginning. But the most effective altruism that you can bring about is to use your skills and education to make as much money as possible and to give as much of it away as you can to your favorite cause.
Yeah, and that gets into the whole idea of the billion-dollar pledges that Warren Buffett and many wealthy people in this country have done.
Right, George Kaiser.
Yeah, George Kaiser. Yeah. In our last couple of minutes, Philip, I want to talk about you because you're actually trying to teach a lot of these concepts of philanthropy to students or to people in the community. Do you feel like that this whole idea of philanthropy, which is certainly a major ingrained part of the American culture, is it not being passed on?
Not as well as it should, and not naturally. It can be taught. It's actually fairly easy to teach, just like any other subject. There are many ways of teaching it. This last summer, I attended a National Philanthropy Educators Symposium at Stanford, and there were about 100 philanthropy teachers there from colleges and universities. And it was interesting to see how many ways there are of teaching philanthropy, from religion and philosophy, history, sociology, but especially from business. Because when you think about it, philanthropy is filled with entrepreneurial instinct. Philanthropy funded a lot of the entrepreneurial work that has resulted in discoveries and processes and so forth. Now, on the other end of that, many businesses are finding that having a philanthropic or charitable component as a part of their business model is helpful to their market, helpful to their success, creates sort of a halo effect that is well received by the public, enables them to hire young persons to come to work because of that. And then, of course, government funds a lot of entrepreneurial efforts through its philanthropy or its support of this work. So to teach the course like I have been from a business school makes a lot of sense. Another valuable teaching tool that is making its way around the country is what I will call learning by giving, and that is finding money from the charitable community or the philanthropic community to actually hand students as a part of the class experience in what's called experiential philanthropy, so that then they can actually then use that money after performing due diligence to distribute to qualified charities. It increases the stakes, it adds to the interest, it adds to the passion, and most colleges and universities following this model have found that it is a very effective teaching technique for students who usually are not able to give money away early in life.
And it instills it for later in life, I would think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, thanks very much, and I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Rich. Enjoyed it.
Philip Haney is an attorney specializing in nonprofit and philanthropic law, and Phil Lakin is the CEO of the Tulsa Community Foundation, speaking about philanthropy today on Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa and you can look through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.